This is a time of year when extended families get together, catch up on family news, eat, celebrate, and for many, to talk politics. With the 2012 presidential election on the horizon, NPR's Debbie Elliott made a stop in Camden, South Carolina, during our recent Hard Times road trip to hear what was on the minds of the close-knit Gaither James family. Like other African Americans who are considered a part of President Obama's political base, they're concerned about the economy and today's political climate.
Members of Camden Second Presbyterian Church recently gathered after Sunday service for a special meal.
And another spoon for macaroni.
The parish house kitchen is a flurry of activity. Longtime church members and sisters, Ernestine James Adams and Althea James Truett, are gathered around the table where Truett is using an electric knife to carve her famous ham. Adams takes a little sample.
She could eat some ham.
The sisters, in their late 70s, have deep roots at Second Presbyterian. Their grandfather was a founding member when the church was established in 1893. Their father, the town's blacksmith, was an elder. As a boy, he attended the church's school, back then the only option for African Americans. On this Sunday evening, Ernestine Adams welcomed several of their cousins to the parish house, telling them what they missed earlier.
You should have been there, Dwight. Mm. That food was out of sight. I'll tell you.
Dwight James is the sister's second cousin and is the state director of the NAACP. He and his wife, Deborah, have 17-year-old twins who will soon be heading off to college in these uncertain times.
It's a difficult forecast for any of us right now because of the state of the economy.
South Carolina has a 10.5% unemployment rate. James is hopeful that a good education will provide opportunities for his sons, just like it's done for generations of the James family. Ernestine Adams and her sister, Althea Truett, both have PhDs. They had distinguished careers in the Northeast and moved back home to Camden to retire. They say it's a different place than when they were growing up, but with some of the same issues, namely lingering racism. The same thing Truett says that's holding the nation back right now.
How can we not carry on a conversation about the state of America without talking about racism?
You know, we need to have this conversation and move on.
That's William Gaither, another cousin.
Well, we can't move on because there is no truth and no reconciliation.
Gaither is recently retired from the South Carolina Department of Employment and Workforce. He doesn't agree with the theory that America moved into a post-racial era when President Obama was elected. Neither does Ernestine Adams.
That's sort of like a cave for hiding.
Adams says denying racism keeps the country from reaching its full economic potential.
You know, a lot of what we are experiencing will not go away until we admit the most outstanding and devastating problem in this country. And it is that people are treated differentially only because they are of a different color.
Her cousin, educator Ann Gaither Cureton, says even President Obama doesn't get the respect he should as president because of the color of his skin.
From South Carolina, a representative to yell out should be decorum. You lie to the president and not be chastised by that?
She's referring to Republican Congressman Joe Wilson, who was rebuked by the U.S. House for the outburst during the president's speech to a joint session of Congress in 2009. Cureton says some Republicans would rather see President Obama fail than the nation prosper. Dwight James thinks that reflects the near toxic political climate today.
It's race, and then it's power. It's control.
The class power.
They don't want to concede that to any other institution, person, or party. She tagged the Republicans. But there are also some Democrats own some of this
absolutely.
As well. There's a group of people in Congress who don't want to share power.
The relatives here don't necessarily agree with some critics on the left who say President Obama hasn't done enough to help the poor and disenfranchised. They say he's done a good job given the obstacles he inherited: the economy, wars abroad, the housing crisis, and now an uncooperative Congress. Althea Truitt.
He has had to go down that lonely road alone. And I admire and respect the fact that it has not knocked the fight out of him, that he wants to run again. I think I would say, to hell with it, you can have it.
Truitt believes the country can recover, but with the unemployment rate in the African American community disproportionately high, the family members here agree there are challenges ahead for the next generation. Deborah Grant James, the mother of the twin teenagers, says what's interesting is to look at the world through their eyes.
To them, capitalism trumps racism. They don't consider that because I'm a black man or a black male, I'm going to be limited. No, they want to compete with whomever is out there.
But they have learned some lessons, she says, like the time one son had the highest average but was passed over for an academic honor that went instead to a white student. They later learned the parents of the winner had donated money to the school.
Instead of taking the adopting the opinion that because he is black, he was discriminated against, he saw it more that the money, because they had the power, he lost.
But it's both.
It is both.
It is both.
This is why. It is both, because racism is embedded in capitalism.
Controlling resources, James says, is how the notion of race got started in the first place and is now why it's still alive today. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
You can follow our Hard Times series at NPR.org and on Twitter at NPR Hard Times. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, having to tackle the emotional and psychological toll of being transgendered is difficult. This is especially true for adolescents. We'll talk with a doctor who specializes in treating transgendered adolescents about a controversial medication that halts puberty. That's in just a few minutes. But first, feeding America's poor during the holidays. The Census Bureau estimates that nearly 50 million Americans are now living below the poverty line, and some food banks across the nation are reporting a sizable drop in food and cash donations, just as the need is growing. Here to talk more about how food banks are managing this are Amy Besunder. She's executive director of North Helpline Emergency Services and Food Bank. It's based in Seattle. Also with us is Ross Fraser. He's the spokesperson for Feeding America, which is one of the nation's largest hunger relief charities. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Amy, let me start with you. We've been hearing from all over the country that food bank donations are down. How are things looking in Seattle?
Well, across the board, food banks in Seattle are reporting a 30% decrease in both cash and food donations, while reporting increases in client need. Personally, at the North Helpline, we've seen over a 50% increase in client base over the last 2 years. And some of the people who used to be donors or provide food to us on a regular basis are now coming to us as clients.
What other different kind of people are you seeing this year? I saw a number somewhere that said that more people are employed that are coming for food help this year than are homeless.
We are seeing more families coming to us, and often there is at least one working parent within those families. However, their employment is tenuous. It may be part-time employment. They may be supporting their spouse as well as children on a single income. And Seattle is quite an expensive city, and attempting to support a family on a single income is quite a challenge here.
Ross, let me bring you into the conversation. Your Feeding America has more than 200 food bank members nationwide. What are you hearing from them? Are donations dwindling for them as well?
Yes. What we are in is what we call a perfect storm. Demand is up. It's up 46% in just the last 4 years. 4 years ago, we were feeding 25 million people a year. We are now feeding 37 million people a year. The good news is we have found more food. We were moving 2 billion pounds of food, and that's billion with a B. Now we are providing more than 3 billion pounds of food a year. but it's not enough. And I will tell you, many of our food banks, as Amy just referenced, will tell you that they're operating in disaster mode. So many people who are unemployed or underemployed just cannot make ends meet and have to show up for a bag of groceries or their family won't eat.
I'm wondering, Ross, if there is a particular group of people who is more impacted by the shortages this year.
Absolutely. I put a list together of my top 10 hunger list. I'll just give you a couple of things. Right now, 1 in 3 Latino children in this country are receiving food from Feeding America. 1 in 4 African-American households is food insecure. 1 in 5 children is food insecure. 1 in 6 Americans are food insecure, and 1 in 7 Americans are receiving food stamps. So we know it disproportionately affects African-Americans and Hispanics, and we're looking to change that. We've got to turn that around.
Ross, I'm curious, are you hearing from your members that they're worried about having to turn people away this year?
Well, yes. I had a very sad story out of Fort Smith, Arkansas, just recently at Thanksgiving time. They had 100 turkeys to give away, and 400 people showed up for the turkeys. So they had to make a decision that if you were there representing the family of 4 or more people, you got a turkey. If you didn't, if you had a smaller family, it was just you, you didn't get a turkey.
We had to employ a similar system with 850 families coming through our door. And so we had about 400 turkeys and also had to make a choice in terms of family size. And that's a really difficult decision to make. We certainly had a lot of tears and a lot of wringing of hands on the part of our clients who were hoping to provide a holiday meal to their families.
Amy, this is 850 people coming through a week?
That's correct.
It can't be easy for the providers to see that either. Ross, I'm curious, where are your donations coming from this year? Is it the same people that have been giving money annually, or is there a different group? Because, as Amy said, some of those who were donors are now clients.
Well, I will tell you, there is good news. And because we're the national office for most of the food banks in the country, our donor base is a little different. So what the good news is that we have so many corporations now coming forward to help us who were not involved in hunger relief previously, particularly financial institutions. Bank of America recently gave us $1 million. Other corporate donors have stepped up to the plate. So our donations from large donors have increased. Our biggest problem, what has happened to us, is that food coming from the federal government through the USDA is a significant chunk of the food that we move. Mm-hmm. It's food that they get from the agricultural community. So it's produce, fruits, vegetables, poultry, eggs,
milk. In other words, it's perishable.
It's perishable, but it's high-quality food. 2 years ago, our network received about $704 million worth of food through the USDA. Now, this year, 2011, that is reduced to $467 million. So we've had to make up for that. So we have to go out and find more food. We have to purchase food, which we didn't do on a large scale 5 or 10 years ago, and having to look for other sources for food.
Let me jump in here for a moment and say, if you're just joining us, I'm Allison Keyes, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're discussing hunger in America and the challenges some food banks are facing this holiday season. With us is Amy Basunder of the Seattle-based North Helpline Emergency Services and Food Bank, and Ross Fraser of Feeding America, one of the nation's largest hunger relief charities. Amy, you're on the ground in Seattle, and I know your organization gets a little bit less than a quarter of its food from Feeding America warehouses. What kind of things have you had to do to adjust what you're able to give people that are coming to you for help? Are you having to give them lesser amounts of food? Are you having to give them different kinds of food?
Unfortunately, we have had to reduce the amount of food that we give to each client who comes through our doors. The poundage has decreased by 10 pounds of food per individual. So we used to give out an average of 30 pounds of food per week to each of our clients, and now we're giving out about 20 pounds of food per week. And so clients are really having to stretch the resources that are available to them. And many of our clients have reported that there are days where they are experiencing actual hunger.
And you've also had to cut back on being able to give people meat, is that right?
Protein is one of the key items that we are seeing our stream dwindle out on. So there have been, for the first time in the years that I had been at the food bank, we have operated a food bank without having the option to offer meat to clients. And that happened in October, and it was quite an alarming experience to open the food bank and have to tell people that we weren't going to be able to offer a completely balanced grocery selection that day.
I was curious, as your clients don't have any other resources except for the food bank if you're unable to help them with proteins, is that right?
That's essentially correct. Food banks serve the communities they exist within, and so our clients can't seek out another community for food. They're reliant on us to be able to provide balanced groceries to their families.
Ross, I wonder, are you hearing that things are worse in some parts of the country than others from your 200 members, or is it pretty much all across the board?
Yes, it is. It is bad across the board. There are particular areas of the country where things are terrible. Things are terrible in Florida, where the real estate market has collapsed. Ohio has lost a lot of businesses. A lot of factories have moved out. I had a heartbreaking conversation with the people in Oklahoma. Their unemployment is not particularly high, but so many people have low-wage jobs in Oklahoma. So when you talk about unemployment, that gives you a false impression, oh, things are okay in Oklahoma. Well, they're not if everyone's making minimum wage or a significant number of people are. But many of our clients receive SNAP, which is formerly known as food stamps. Mm-hmm. SNAP is supplemental, and most people, most families' food stamps run out by the middle of the month. So if we can't help them, there is nowhere else for them to turn. When our pantries are bare, these families have nowhere else to go, and that's just heartbreaking.
And Amy, let me ask you, you're on the ground. Do you need volunteers? Say people in Seattle could come knock on your door tomorrow. If they don't have cash to give, is there something else they can do to help you?
Absolutely. We utilize over 200 volunteers each week to operate our food bank. It runs the course of sorting food, actually distributing food, delivering food to our homebound and elderly clients. We need help. And so we always appreciate our volunteers coming forward and making sure that their neighbors in need are cared for.
Ross, let me just ask you one final question. There are some signs that the economy is beginning to recover. Is there a light at the end of this tunnel?
There is a light at the end of the tunnel, but it's far away. And I will tell you, for people who are at the low end of the economic system structure in this country, when the economy gets better, the people at the bottom are always the last people to benefit. So unemployment has been about 9% for a long, long time. We are looking for more food and we're looking for more money because we know that there is going to be tremendous need for the foreseeable future.
Ross Fraser is a spokesperson for Feeding America, which is one of the nation's largest hunger relief charities. It has more than 200 food bank members nationwide. He joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. And Amy Besunder is executive director of North Helpline Emergency Services and Food Bank in Seattle. She joined us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
For many years, people in St. Paul, Minnesota supported themselves with jobs at a Ford Motor Company plant. Now that plant is closed and Ford is preparing to sell the property. The real estate could have a new economic life. It's in a quiet residential neighborhood and a scenic river bluff, an attractive property. But in today's real estate market, redevelopment may take time. Here's Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio.
It's not easy to make a 2-million-square-foot factory blend into its surroundings, but industrial architect Albert Kahn did. The plant's classical stone facade flows along a Mississippi River bluff. The red tile roof of the hydroelectric plant glows in the sunlight, and Tia Anderson, who lives near the plant in the Highland Park neighborhood, says this behemoth was scarcely a bother.
A lot of people don't even notice that it's there. I mean, it is sort of walled off almost physically from the rest of Highland. So a lot of people don't necessarily think about it day to day.
But they will soon, as Ford puts this prime piece of land in the heart of the Twin Cities metro up for sale. Hydropower and silica for glassmaking brought Henry Ford here a century ago, and today city officials hope the scenery and central location will attract someone with a new vision. As the last few Rangers rolled toward the exit this month, worker Steve Overby popped each hood to check the fit. Then he nudged the hinges with his mallet. Overby's job, using hand tools in a factory full of robots, is a throwback to the earliest days of automaking. On this very spot, his predecessors churned out Model Ts and Model As. Ken Muxlow started work at the plant in 1929 making seat cushions. In an oral history interview shortly before his death in 2000, he said those pre-union years were tough and unpredictable.
The line kept going no matter what. If you had to go to the bathroom, you had to go, and you had to catch up your job when you got back. They didn't give you any time.
The threat of losing defense contracts during World War II forced Henry Ford to negotiate with the United Auto Workers, and conditions slowly improved. The assembly lines produced tanks and armored cars. Post-war, it was Fairlane, station wagons, and trucks. Now Ford has ended Ranger production and closed the plant, even though it's hiring again elsewhere. While tales of life on the line will remain for historians and former workers, the future of the 122-acre site lies with a developer, once Ford finds one. St. Paul Planning Director Cecile Bedore says the job losses are unfortunate, but the plant's closing offers a rare chance for a city with little empty land to do something ambitious.
What it does present is a really exciting opportunity to really realize a beautiful development that's really going to add to this community and the region. And really, our hope is to showcase how to do really good development.
What that might be is anyone's guess. Ideas range from light manufacturing to a data center in the old silica mine to housing. With the Mississippi River nearby, Bedore says attracting a green development is a priority. But defunct factory sites in gritty industrial suburbs have proven tough to sell. And even though this one is in a thriving residential neighborhood, University of St. Thomas real estate professor George Carvell says finding the right buyer could take years.
It's a great piece of property for retail, for single-family housing, for apartments, but just not today.
Crews will spend the next year demolishing the buildings. After that, they have to figure out how polluted the land is after 9 decades of manufacturing. Cleanup will likely take several more years, but by then, city leaders say they hope the economy will have finally caught up with their ambitions. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in St. Paul.
Late last week, Majority Leader Harry Reid hinted that he might revive the push for a millionaire surtax. Republicans argue it would hit small business owners particularly hard and could stifle job creation. Well, the next time the surtax could come up is when lawmakers start negotiating over the extension of the year-long payroll tax cut early next year. Frank Morris of member station KCUR went to Minneapolis, Kansas to talk with one small business owner who says the surtax would impede his ability to invest in the expansion of his business. But that is not his biggest concern.
There aren't many people out on the broad Kansas prairie, but there is industry. Here at G.L. Hewitt, boxing machines jammed into a big metal building grind steel into heavy transmission parts.
Very oddball. Think very big, very little. Unusual materials.
Tim O'Keefe runs and owns this company.
We're a supplier of last resort. So you have disruptions in the supply chain. Someone can't meet a shipping time.
May sound marginal, but it's not. About 100 people work here, manufacturing, selling, and shipping. That's up from just 4 employees 20 years ago. And Wayne Arthur here toils long hours to keep up with demand.
It's been 10-hour days and half days on Saturday, and that's been since probably April.
Record sales are earning Tim O'Keefe a bundle. He'd have to pay the surtax on income over $1 million that Democrats have proposed. Earlier this month, NPR searched for someone who makes that kind of money, creates jobs, and doesn't like the surtax idea. When it came up blank, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid called such millionaire job creators unicorns. Hard to find, and in fact, non-existent. Well,
I am a unicorn. What we have here in front of us is our 2010 corporate tax return, and you can see that we're a subchapter S corporation as well as my own personal income tax return.
Subchapter S corporation. That means that all the company's profits are counted as income for the owner, It's a common small business setup. O'Keefe says the surtax would hurt his business more than his personal bank account. It would cut into his profits, which he says he needs to invest in order to expand and to stay ahead of the competition.
This is my unicorn mobile. It has a F-150 pickup with 231,000 miles on it.
O'Keefe takes me to another building, a big metal one across town. It's recently refurbished, but mostly empty.
So this is our future.
But it's not taxes or even the threat of them that stops O'Keefe from hiring and filling this building.
We've got the space, we have the equipment, we have the cash, we have the customers, we have the products, we have everything we need except the people.
He can create jobs, but he can't fill them. There are two issues here. For one, the company is picky, and O'Keefe admits not the easiest place to work. They expect a lot from their employees, but the main problem, he says, is location. No amount of recruiting seems sufficient to get enough people to move out to Minneapolis, Kansas. Population, 2017.
Small town. Like, I mean, there's just not a lot of people to meet, really. I mean, you're kind of stuck with the same people.
Patrick Arvello, a teenager sitting in the barbershop downtown, says it's friendly and comfortable, but he plans to leave right after graduation. Tim O'Keefe understands why potential employees might miss city life, but not why they won't follow work as urgently as Americans did in the Great Depression.
When I see the state of Michigan with unemployment rates north of 10%, I don't understand why those people, just like Tom Joad did in the dirty 30s, get in the car, throw grandma on the roof, and drive to Kansas and work for a productive 100-year-old company like G.L. Hewitt.
But Americans are not moving like they used to. The mobility rate is the lowest on record.
We're really just stuck.
Bill Fry with the Brookings Institution says Americans are digging in, even where jobs are scarce.
In fact, Michigan is no longer losing population. Now, that's after several years of having some out-migration. You can make the case there that the people who wanted to leave already have left, and the rest of them are happy to sort of stay there and ride it out.
Bad news for G.L. Hewitt, and potentially for Minneapolis, Kansas. O'Keefe says if he can't crack this mobility problem, he's going to have to take at least part of his job creation machine someplace else. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.